Seminar. My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation in Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as the technical moderator for today's webinar. Again, we'll be covering the NARPM Presents session on ICs, or Institutional Controls and Decision Documents, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Before we begin the technical portion of today's broadcast, before I turn things over to your three instructors, again, who will be joining you as well from the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, as well as from EPA Region 5, I'm going to walk through a few preliminary instruction items and reminders for those of you joining us for the live broadcast. When you registered for today's session, you should have received a confirmation email with a complete set of instructions to join us for the live broadcast. That email also would have been followed by a reminder email that went out in the past 24 hours. The emails will ultimately point you to something known as the seminar homepage, where you can find out more about the event. You'll see a complete description for today's broadcast. You'll find contact information and bios for our instructors as well as myself. There's a link to download a copy of the PowerPoint presentation materials in PDF format. There's even a link to an online feedback form, which you can fill out after today's live broadcast. For now, though, to join us for the live broadcast, you want to click a button labeled Go to Seminar, which appears in the upper left corner of that page. Once you click that button, you will be asked to identify yourself by name as well as the number of people at your location, and you should be successfully checked in online to our live broadcast. If you have any problems checking in online, first check to make sure you're entering in your first and last name the same way you spelled it when you registered. And if that continues to be a problem for you, just let us know. You can simply download a copy of the slides and follow along via telephone line. If you are able to successfully check in online, you should be brought on board to a fully interactive Adobe Connect environment that we'll be using for today's live broadcast. Through Adobe Connect, your presenters will be able to walk through a series of PowerPoint presentations in real time while you watch and listen from various locations across the country. We will have a series of interactive polls throughout today's training, so there will be some questions that will appear during the webinar, and you will be asked to vote or answer on some of these interactive polls to help our instructors as they move through the materials. So I highly encourage you to try to join us or let us know if you're having technical problems joining us online so we can troubleshoot those and get you on board for the fully interactive experience. By default, audio will be available online through Adobe Connect. You should be able to hear me either through your computer speakers or the pair of headphones. If you're having problems with the online audio, make sure the green speaker icon is turned on in your Adobe Connect window. If it's gray, you might want to click on it to enable or start the online audio. Then locally check your own volume settings. Sometimes it's just a matter of increasing your speaker output on your computer to make sure that the volume is adjusted loud enough at your location. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for those who need to join us on the phones. Just know if you join us on the phones, you will be placed in a global mute, and we ask that you remain globally muted to cut down on background noises and other audio disruptions. In the lower right corner of your screen, you should see an interactive Q&A window, which already has a welcome message from me, Jean Ballant. You can use that Q&A window to submit questions, comments, as well as to report technical problems at any time. In fact, feel free to test that window out now while we're going through these instructions. It's a private window, which means no one else can read what you type into that window. And while we will be taking a break after the presentation and interactive polls where we'll go through questions from the audience, there's no need to wait for that break. In fact, I highly encourage you to submit your comments and questions during the presentation as we're going through the slides so that we can create a nice, healthy question queue and get through as many questions as we can in the time that we have allotted today. Again, if you have any technical problems, please feel free to use that window and let us know. We'll be more than happy to help troubleshoot those issues. Today's session is being recorded, and you'll automatically receive a link to replay that recording in about 1 to 2 weeks as soon as we have that archive available. If you're interested in looking at our current archives, we do have nearly 600 previously recorded internet seminars available for free replay through the CLUIN archive. So one quick reminder, you should see a window like this on the left side where the presentation materials will be displayed. There's a button that looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions in the far right, which will make the slides bigger if you click it once. And if you click it a second time, it'll shrink the slides back down. You can feel free to make the slides bigger and smaller as needed for your own increased viewing experience. And then, as I mentioned earlier, along the right-hand side, you'll see information about our sponsors and presenters in the upper right corner. A collection of related URLs appears here in the middle right. You can click on any one of those links and press the Browse to button to open them up. And then, of course, that interactive Q&A window we just highlighted in the lower right. You can submit your comments and questions by typing here into that empty box or field at the very bottom and either hit the Enter key or press the cartoon bubble button to the right when you are done with your question to submit it in. I think it's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to go ahead and presentation materials in preparation to kick off today's live broadcast. Again, you should be joining us for today's NARPM Presents Internet Seminar, where we'll be looking at institutional controls and decision documents. I'm going to turn things over to your very first speaker. So Steve, whenever you're ready to begin.
Thanks very much, Jean. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our NARPM Presents webinar on institutional controls and decision documents. As Jean said, my name is Steve Ridenour. I work in the Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation in EPA headquarters. And I'm joined by Melanie Keller of my office and Sherry Bianchin of EPA Region 5, who will also be presenting material here today. Today's presentation will provide a high-level overview of ICs and the remedy selection process under CERCLA. Specifically, I'll provide some general background information on ICs. Melanie will go through some considerations for selecting ICs at Superfund sites and how those ICs should be documented in decision documents. And Sherry will cover some useful IC planning steps that can be conducted during and after the selection phase. After we cover this material, we'd like to use the balance of our time to answer questions from you. So with that summary, let's proceed in some more detail. First, let's start with some basics. EPA defines ICs as non-engineered instruments such as administrative and legal controls that help to minimize the potential for exposure to contamination and or protect the integrity of the remedy, the response action. To achieve this, ICs limit land and resource use by providing information that helps guide or modify human behavior at a site. ICs can be used on a more temporary basis, say for instance to prevent consumption of groundwater until federal MCLs are reached, or on a permanent basis, such as a cap landfill that will leave waste in place in perpetuity. For purposes of this presentation and our guidance, we divide ICs into four distinct categories or types. The first category is proprietary controls. Proprietary controls refer to controls on land or resource use that are established between a property owner and a second party who can enforce these controls. Common examples include easements that restrict use and restrictive covenants. State and tribal law typically authorize proprietary controls. Some states have even enacted statutes that directly authorize these types of controls for the purpose of preventing uses that conflict with environmental contamination or remedies. These statutes tend to divide into ones modeled after what you'll hear is the Uniform Environmental Covenants Act, or UECA, and other non-UECA statutes. Both UECA and non-UECA state statutes can provide advantages over traditional common law proprietary controls. The second IC category is governmental controls. These types of controls impose restrictions on land or resource use using the authority of a government entity. Typical examples of governmental controls include zoning, building codes, groundwater use regulations, commercial fishing bans, and sports and recreational fishing limits. For federal facility sites, in many cases, federal landholding agencies, such as the Department of Defense, possess the authority to enforce ICs on their property. And in active federal facilities, land or resource use restrictions may be addressed in base master plans, facility construction review processes, facility digging permit systems, and facility well permitting systems. Third type of IC category is enforcement and permit tools with IC components. These are legal tools such as administrative orders, permits, federal facility agreements, and consent decrees that limit certain site activities or require the performance of specific activities, such as the monitoring and reporting of IC effectiveness. These legal tools may be issued unilaterally in the case of a unilateral administrative order or negotiated in the case of a consent decree. And lastly, the fourth IC category is informational devices. Informational devices provide information or notification, often as recorded notice in property records or as advisories to local communities, tourists, recreational users, or other interested persons that residual contamination remains on site. Informational devices, however, generally do not provide enforceable restrictions. Typical informational devices include state registries of contaminated sites, notices and deeds, tracking systems, and fish and shellfish consumption advisories. And a word of caution that depending on the cleanup authority at the site, you may hear a few terms which can include ICs as we define them here, but also engineering controls like fencing and security guards. In the federal facilities program, you may hear the term land use controls or LUCs. And in the removal program, Superfund removal program, you may hear the term post-removal site controls or PRSCs. To give you a sense of how widely ICs are used, when we surveyed all existing decision documents, we find that over 75% of remedies require ICs as a component of the remedy. Through EPA's IC tracking system, or ICTS, we can obtain an estimate of the ongoing IC workload throughout the Superfund program. ICTS is a centralized database for the site-specific status of ICs and mostly construction complete sites. Construction complete sites are those where all physical construction of the remedy is complete and for which we expect IC implementation to be substantially underway or complete. ICTS tells us that over 50% of these mostly construction complete sites require some future IC work, including the implementation of new ICs, changes in the scope of existing ICs, or sites that need additional characterization to determine the need for ICs. The five-year view process under CERCLA provides a great built-in opportunity to review the status of ICs at a site. Sites that rely on ICs as part of the remedy will likely be subject to the five-year view requirement under CERCLA because waste will be left in place above levels that allow for unlimited use and unrestricted exposure at the site. In addition to the protectiveness determination, five-year reviews may identify IC-related issues and recommend the need for additional evaluation or follow-up actions to address ICs. The biggest issue found in five-year reviews with respect to ICs is still getting them implemented. Other common issues include the need to develop an IC plan or the need to enforce ICs due to an observed breach at the site. And EPA has released guidance on evaluating ICs during the five-year review process in September 2011, and we encourage you to take a look at this guidance. On the note of guidance, I briefly wanted to share some other IC guidance documents that we hope can be a useful resource to you as you're considering selecting ICs as part of the CERCLA remedy. The PIME guidance identifies and addresses many of the common issues that may be encountered when using ICs pursuant to several of the agency's cleanup programs. So not just Superfund remedial and removal, but federal facilities, brownfields, underground storage tanks, and Resource Conservation and Recovery Act sites, or RCRA. It also provides an overview of the agency's policy regarding the roles and responsibilities of stakeholders involved in various aspects of the IC lifecycle, in this case, namely the planning, implementing, maintaining, and enforcing of ICs, or PIME. The ICAP guidance provides EPA regions with a template for developing IC plans, or what we call ICAPs, at contaminated sites where the response action includes ICs. An ICAP is a document designed to systematically establish and document the activities associated with implementing and ensuring the long-term stewardship of ICs, and specify the persons or entities that will be responsible for conducting these activities. Sherry will actually cover ICAPs in more detail toward the end of this presentation. The last item on the slide, the third item, I just shared that with you previously. This is the guidance on ICs during the five-year review process. Last but not least, EPA's Enforcement Office finalized a handbook that covers the implementation of ICs in Indian Country. Indian law presents unique challenges and circumstances that can be distinguished from EPA's current IC practice and guidance that is derived from traditional English and American real property law and government legal theory. This cross-program handbook is designed to recognize these unique circumstances, to reinforce the EPA's policy to engage tribes early in the cleanup process, and to ensure that tribes receive the same level of protectiveness as states during and after cleanups. So now that you have some general background on ICs, I wanted to segue into ICs and the remedy selection process in particular. When considering ICs and the remedy selection process, it's important to keep in mind the expectations for ICs that were set forth in the National Contingency Plan, or the NCP. Here are some direct quotes from the NCP that discuss ICs, but I'll summarize each in turn for you. First, ICs generally are expected to supplement engineered remedies at a site. Second, ICs generally should not substitute for active response actions as a sole remedy at the site unless taking active measures is found to be impracticable. And lastly, ICs should supplement remedial actions that leave waste in place above unlimited use or unrestricted exposure, or what we call UUUE. So now that I've gone through some of these expectations, I want to turn it over to Melanie, who would discuss how ICs should be considered and documented during the remedy selection process.
Thank you, Steve. Hello, everyone. My name is Melanie Keller, and I work alongside of Steve at headquarters as a remedy decision regional coordinator. I'm going to walk you through some of the basics of documenting institutional controls and decision documents. The information I'm about to provide pulls directly from our statute, our policy and guidance, and provides some helpful tips for how to include ICs in your decision documents. Keep in mind that none of this information is new policy. I'm just highlighting the major points that headquarter regional coordinators look for when reading your documents. To start off, the overall point to make with regard to documenting ICs is that if ICs are needed for protectiveness at a site, for either the short or the long term, they should be appropriately documented in your decision documents. These decision documents include RODs, ROD amendments, ESDs, and notes to the file. And just to refresh, your decision documents should be the official public record of your selected remedy and one that provides the public with a consolidated summary of information about the site and the selected remedy and the rationale behind the selection. These documents should certify that the remedy selection process was carried out in accordance with CERCLA and the NCB and should describe the technical parameters of the remedy. It should cite the specific methods selected to protect human health and the environment. If ICs are a component of your cleanup plan, they should be described as part of your remedy. I'd also like to point out that ICs by themselves are considered to be limited actions rather than active remedial measures, as Steve implied. And they should generally accompany active remedial measures rather than substitute for them. In other words, selecting an IC-only remedy would generally be inconsistent with the expectations of the NCP. When you're thinking about including ICs as part of your remedies, you should consider the following things. What is the current and future anticipated land use of the site, and how does this relate to the risk pathways? If you have demonstrated risk from residential land use, an IC can be considered in the short or long term to prevent residential use of the property while you are remediating the site. In general, if you did not expect a specific land use when you are considering future use and evaluating risks, there would be limited logic to use an IC to prevent an unanticipated use. Also, when you're looking at early and interim actions, as you may know, we have the authority to select actions before the final remedy has been selected. We can select an early action or an interim action to more quickly provide protection from immediate threats. ICs could be included as part of an early or interim action to prevent the use of a site while additional investigations are being performed to select a final remedy. In some cases, it will not be possible to remediate a site or to meet your applicable or relevant and appropriate requirements, or ARARs. One example of this is when you've identified that remedial actions cannot remediate a groundwater plume, and you'll not be able to meet your ARAR, which is generally the MCL. In this case, you would document a technical and practicability ARAR waiver to show that you are waiving this threshold criteria. ICs can play a critical role at TI waiver and other ARAR waiver sites. At these sites, you've waived the AROR for groundwater, but you're still required to meet the second threshold criteria, which is protection of human health and the environment. ICs can provide a long-term restriction to prevent site uses that pose an unacceptable risk. And at TI sites, this could be the prevention of groundwater use in perpetuity. When you're identifying ICs, you should ensure that you've evaluated the likelihood of state and community to concur with the remedy that includes ICs. Reaching out to the other agencies and the community should be part of your IC plan and should be carefully considered before you select the ICs. Sherry will talk a bit more about collaboration later. And finally, in some other cases, agencies, including state and county environmental agencies, will have an existing IC in place that prevents the use that poses a risk at your site. For example, there are some counties in the country that have enacted county-wide bans on the withdrawal of groundwater because of ubiquitous contamination. This can be incredibly helpful at a site when you need an IC to prevent the use of groundwater while you're remediating. However, note that the existence of a county IC does not mean that EPA does not need to officially select an IC as a remedy. I'll again highlight note from my first slide and remind you that if an IC is required to provide protectiveness at a site, it needs to be included as part of the remedy and documented appropriately. In other words, at this site where there's the county ban, your remedy would identify that groundwater ICs are needed to prevent exposure to contaminated groundwater, and you would acknowledge that the county restriction currently satisfies your IC needs.
Melanie, before you go any further, I just wanted to highlight for some of the participants, we do have one of our interactive poll questions available in the lower left half of the screen, where we've asked the audience if they've worked on a decision document that includes institutional controls. For those of you who haven't voted yet, you can submit your vote by clicking on the empty box to the left of the answer that best matches your own reply. If you're sharing the line for multiple people in one room, you guys will need to fight it out and come up with one group answer. Right now, it looks like about three-quarters of the audience, about 73%, have worked on one in the past, and about 37% of the audience is currently working on a decision document that includes ICs right now, and just under around 17% of the audience have not worked on one that have included institutional controls.
Okay, thanks everyone for participating, and thank you, Jean. And again, it looks like the numbers show the importance of ICs in our decision documents, and it echoes Steve's data that shows how ICs are being portrayed in our documents and being used across the country. All right, moving forward, talking about the overview of documenting ICs. Keep in mind that when you're documenting institutional controls, you should have the same fundamental information for ICs as you do for other remedial components. As with other remedial decision documents, the story should be clear. And when I say the story of a decision document, I'm talking about the general layout of information, from site history, contaminants and risk, to your remedial action, objectives, and remedial alternatives. It should be clear in all of your decision documents how the selected remedy was chosen and it was based on site-specific conditions. Your level of detail for ICs in a decision document should be appropriate to document the general scope and intent of the restrictions you require for protectiveness. We call this substantive documentation. ICs should also be described sufficiently so that the public can provide meaningful comments on this component of the remedy. Providing opportunities for meaningful public comment is a requirement of our statute and is generally covered by the proposed plan process. Again, the public should understand the scope and intent of the proposed IC restrictions, and the potentially affected parties should be provided adequate opportunities to gain access to the proposed remedy and to understand the implications of these restrictions from the text in your documents. I'm now going to walk you through the different sections of a decision document to identify the main areas where IC information should be included for substantive documentation. In general, these sections are found in RODs and ROD amendments. If you are writing an ESD or notes to the file, you should consider how the story of your site has been captured in previous documents and identify any areas where you should update information to appropriately document ICs. Okay, with regard to the trigger for action, the site characterization and risk summary sections of the document should clearly identify the risk pathways that pose an unacceptable risk to your receptors. The trigger for action is required to have the statutory authority to select remedial actions to address each risk pathway. Here's an example of how a trigger for action is developed in the risk summary and site characterization sections. I'm going to read this, quote, VOC contamination in the groundwater plume underlying the site presents an unacceptable risk to residents using the groundwater. The VOC contamination, PCE, occurs at levels several orders of magnitude above the MCL and presents a carcinogenic risk to child and adult residents at 3 times 10 to the minus third. In this risk language, you can clearly read that PCE in groundwater presents a cancer risk outside of EPA's acceptable risk range to residents. And then from the land use part of the site characterization section, I'll read again, the current and anticipated future use is residential. Groundwater at the site is not currently being used, but it has been classified by the state and EPA as a Class 2 aquifer, a potential source of drinking water. In this land use discussion, you can see that the residential use of the property is already occurring, but that the public is currently getting their drinking water from elsewhere. However, when the classification is for potential use of drinking water, even if the public is not currently using it, there is a potential in the future that exposure would occur. Therefore, these two pieces of information provide the trigger for action to prevent exposure and the use of groundwater as drinking water. Now, once you've established your trigger for action and laid out the risk pathways and receptors, you can develop meaningful remedial action objectives, or RAOs. The RAOs establish the remedial goals for your alternatives to protect human health and the environment. They should be carefully developed to tie directly to the risks you've identified in the earlier sections of the document. In keeping with the same example for groundwater, here's an RAO. Prevent human exposure to contaminated groundwater above levels that are protective of residential exposure, or the MCL. An RAO should clearly identify the media and pathways of concern, as well as set a measurable goal for protection. Here you can see that we need to prevent exposure to the groundwater of residents above the MCL. RAOs should also be backed up by cleanup level information, sometimes tables in a document, so that the MCL for the contaminant is clearly defined. As we move forward with the story of the site, we build upon the information from the risk in the background and the RAOs to develop and describe the alternatives for the site. These alternatives should be tailored to the site and should represent a summary of the remedial options and technologies available to achieve the RAOs that you presented and to provide protection of human health and environment and to comply with the ARARs. The description of each alternative in this section should contain enough information so that the comparative analysis of alternatives, which is the next section of the ROD, can focus on the differences or similarities among alternatives with respect to the 9 evaluation criteria. There are a couple of ways to identify ICs as part of your remedial alternatives. This may vary based on the amount of detail that the project manager chooses to include in the alternatives and selected remedy description. Some RPMs choose to include a, quote, common elements section for all alternatives, which may include components of the remedial action that are similar for all alternatives. And this can generally include things like monitoring and also institutional controls. ICs can be the same for all alternatives, or they may be different across alternatives based on the variability of the active remedial components. If the ICs vary between alternatives, then it's more appropriate to describe the substantive requirements the ICs in the description of each individual alternative. Here's an example of how ICs can be incorporated in the description of a common elements section of the alternatives. I'm going to give you a brief moment to read this before I summarize. As you can see, the text describes that for all remedies, groundwater use should be restricted, using ICs to prevent installation of wells and withdrawal of water throughout the contaminated VOC plume. Later in this presentation, I'll show you some examples of how ICs can be described in individual alternatives through the discussion of a selected remedy. The comparative analysis of alternatives, otherwise known as the 9 criteria analysis, is a requirement for RODs and ROD amendments. The comparative analysis should clearly identify the rationale for selecting the preferred alternative by demonstrating the relative performance of the alternatives so that you can see the advantages and disadvantages of each and they can be clearly understood. ICs should be screened as part of the advantages and disadvantages of an alternative along with all of the other remedial components. The role of ICs should be evident in these comparisons. I apologize, my computer has frozen on the wrong slide. Oh. Okay, here we go. On slide 21, in this slide I've identified three of the nine criteria where the role of ICs may generally be highlighted for comparison. In the overall protectiveness of human health and the environment criteria, a project manager should discuss the role that ICs play in providing protectiveness of receptors for specific media. The comparison should also identify if ICs are being used to provide long or short-term protectiveness at the site. And keep in mind that some ICs may be used temporarily, while others may be required in perpetuity to ensure long-term protectiveness. This distinction should be clearly identified in the comparison. For sites when ICs are being relied upon to ensure long-term protectiveness of receptors, it is appropriate to identify the role of ICs in the long-term effectiveness criteria. This criteria is defined as the adequacy and reliability of controls, such as containment systems and institutional controls, which are necessary to manage treatment residuals and untreated waste. In this criteria, ICs should be compared to other remedial components in the alternatives that also provide long-term effectiveness for the site. Finally, the cost criteria is another element of the comparative analysis where ICs should be reflected. Here, although ICs are not specifically called out, they should be included in the overall O&M costs when you're presenting the comparison among the alternatives. I will now present you with two examples of text from decision documents that include ICs as part of the selected remedy. The level of detail varies between these examples, but the fundamental scope and intent of the ICs are evident in both. Again, the level of detail should be sufficient so that the substantive restrictions intended by the remedy can be clearly understood. And now I apologize at how fast we're moving through these examples of the text, and I know this is a lot of information to read during this presentation, but please note, as Jean said, that the copies of the presentation will be made available to you into the future. So I'll give you a little bit of time to read this and then summarize. Okay, in this first example, even though it says example two, the ROD does not clearly identify the mechanisms by which the ICs will be employed at the site, but the text clearly identifies that the intent of the restrictions will be to prevent the use of contaminated groundwater and the property until remediation is complete. In this second example, there's a lot more detail provided, and it's provided in a bulleted list. And again, I'm not going to give you a whole lot of time to read it, but as I scan through this slide and then the next slide, and this is the entire description of institutional controls for the selected remedy, you can see how the restrictions are clearly described and what is intended for the site. And what is intended is to prohibit the residential use of the property. And on the next slide, you can see that the mechanisms by which EPA intends to implement the ICs is through a combination of covenants and deed notices. Okay, we've reached the end of my portion of the presentation, and in summary, I just wanted to let you know that I hope that these slides have identified the primary elements of decision documents where ICs should be highlighted. Remember that the decision document is the formal certification of the rationale for the selected remedy, and if ICs are a component of your remedy, they should be identified alongside of all the other components in your decision documents. Thank you for your time, and I'll now pass it along to Sherry to discuss additional elements for illustrating ICs and some tips for planning and developing them. Sherry?
Thank you, Jean, Steve, and Melanie. First, I'll introduce myself. My name is Sherry Bianchin. I'm an environmental engineer. I work for US EPA in Region 5 Chicago, the center of the polar vortex, I think, right now. I've worked for EPA for about 31 years. And I've been in the Superfund program for about 21 years, and I've been the Superfund IC coordinator for about 10 years. I'm going to go ahead and piggyback on what Steve and Melanie were talking about the importance of getting information into the decision documents relative to ICs. Remember, our goal is to get the ICs in place clearly described in the decision documents so that when we go to implement them, there should be no questions. However, that has not been historically done. Just a little history on this. EPA has put a lot of policies out in the last 10 years or so to try to get our arms around what ICs mean and how are we to implement them and the pros and cons. So many of our historic sites where ICs were selected, we did not have a lot of information to go on. And so it is not uncommon to see an older decision document which just references ICs to say ICs should be implemented or deed restrictions should be implemented or not even going that far and just kind of missing that entirely. But in review here, just remember the ICs, like active remedial components, should be tied to the specific release and location of contamination that poses the unacceptable risk. So just like any other remedial component, ICs should be those factors should be considered for ICs as well. Therefore, the scope and the location of the IC should be carefully considered and tailored to the areas where the contamination has an unacceptable risk for that pathway. So generally, that will be the areas where UUUE has not been achieved, and that's been described previously what that means. So in other words, we don't want to just apply ICs to an entire site or an entire area or just everywhere we can think of just in case. We want to be to use our approach, our scientific information, and our policies and guidance and what we know about ICs to select the ICs that will work for our situation. We want our ICs to be effective and reliable. Okay, some of the considerations to look at to ensure reliability and effectiveness of ICs are that we can use multiple ICs or layers of ICs for a certain area or media. Steve described the four basic types of ICs. So, for example, you may have an area or many properties that have groundwater contamination, and you may consider using restrictive covenants for each parcel or property to restrict groundwater use, and you may look at using a local ordinance for groundwater well installation prevention or regulation. And maybe hand in hand, the two will get the most effectiveness and reliability. But these are things we should be considering. IC should also be scaled for various uses as appropriate, meaning the areas should match up where the ICs, the restrictions discussed in the ICs should match up closely to where the areas of contamination are. And also another consideration is that we can look at buffer zones as appropriate, meaning we may want to include areas outside the actual contaminated areas for restriction based on our best judgment that we want to be able to prevent some kind of impact to the contaminated area. So the best example for that would be if you have a groundwater plume where you're not exactly sure where the edges of the plume are, maybe then you'll go further. The ICs or the restrictions on the groundwater usage might be beyond what you think you know of the area to ensure that no one is going to be impacted. Or even if you are quite sure where the contamination is, you might want to prevent others from zones outside the contamination from using the groundwater to extract it or to pull the contamination out into those clean areas. So those would be some examples of buffer zones. They can be considered and they should be documented and included as appropriate. So one of the most important points that we want to make is that figures and maps are really a very important way to document where the contamination is, the areas where UUUE will not be achieved, and the areas where ICs have been implemented. And through a series of maps, we've been able to really go a lot further in our understanding of getting these ICs in place and understanding where the ICs are necessary. Just like the old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words, we really want to impress that the figures and maps should be hand-in-hand with the text and the technical documentation that we're looking at to select and implement ICs. Maps and figures are important for the public to understand. They seem to like that. And then also for us internally, EPA and the states help us to understand further where we need to implement the ICs or where they've been implemented already. So remember, the ICs should be carefully considered and applied to each media of concern. It helps us to get the objectives that we need. Those should be clearly stated. And also the maps should work hand in hand with that. Okay, now I did mention earlier that ICs should not be selected in large areas or just in case areas. We should have some documentation of where we need to include the areas that need to be further regulated, further restricted, further managed. So just to kind of go further with that, some of the harm in selecting ICs outside of an area contamination might include we may not have the authority to do that. Remember, we have to have the authority to actually select a remedy, and so we need to make sure that we have that authority and that, you know, we have some basis for the restriction. If we do not, we may be opening ourselves up. The agency could be opening ourselves up to some lawsuits for like a takings without just compensation, or some reopening of records of decision unnecessarily, which could cause delays. But also, in a practical sense, unnecessary restrictions can harm land use. Reasonably anticipated land use could be harmed. The public, maybe, a landowner might be thinking they can't use their land for a particular use because of the IC, but maybe that's not true. It was just applied, without the thought involved. It may also limit development in the areas. So, again, there could be some harm in selecting ICs outside of an area of contamination. It should be considered, and tailored for each area that we need it. Now, some of the examples of how maps and figures can be used to depict the contamination and the ICs are shown in this bullet here. So you can see, like, we might have specific maps for soil areas of contamination and soil IC figures. We may have separate maps, or maybe even the same map of groundwater area of contamination, which also could include the area of influence outside the area of contamination if there is any area of influence that we need to be concerned with. It may include other administrative boundaries. For example, maps can depict parcel numbers, which may be important in certain cases. It could depict county boundaries, which may be important when we're looking at, say, jurisdiction of a certain county to impose restrictions in an ordinance, things of that nature. So these maps can be used in multiple ways, and I'm going to give a few examples to show how they can be used. And can you see the arrow, Gene?
We're going to bring that arrow back up. And while I bring the pointer up for you, just a gentle reminder for participants, if you're having any problems viewing the images on the screen, remember that there is that full screen button, the four arrows pointing in opposite directions, which you guys should see in the upper right of the slide window. So you might find it helpful to actually make the slides go full screen while Sherry walks through these figures. And to shrink them back down, you'll simply hover your cursor in the upper right and click the four arrowed button again to shrink them back down to normal size.
Thank you. Okay, so what I'm showing here is an example of a map, an IC overlay map, and I'm going to take this arrow and just point out a few features. First of all, importantly, I think it's we think it's important to include a disclaimer, and in case you can't read this, this is one of the disclaimers that we've come up with for some maps, and there may be other ways to present this information, but the idea here is that the disclaimer will say that we're fairly certain with the information, but it is does not represent maybe survey information, or it may not be used in place of other due diligence. So the wording on this one says this map and any boundary lines within the map are approximate and subject to change. The map does not purport to be a survey. This map is informational for informational purposes only regarding EPA's response action at the site and is not intended for any other purpose. So again, we're just concerned that someone take the map and use it you know, as a very precise measurement of where contamination is, and that's not what it's meant to do. Another important thing that you won't see is a date on this map, but we really emphasize having dates on maps is a good idea because information does change, and therefore you can compare and contrast based on dates. So that would be one thing to consider. Okay, another thing you'll see here from this map are these diagonal lines here, and what this represents are the parcel numbers, and these are the ones that the taxing unit of the government, the local government, have come up with for parcels, and these are not always set in stone. They can change. There can be subdivisions of parcels and things like that, but parcels are usually how property is described, and so it's important to understand that and, you know, to get that mapped. One of the most important reasons we use parcels is to order surveys. Surveys are usually done by title companies based on parcels, so that's something that you might see here that you might need. But you can also see how it causes the map to be quite busy with, you know, all of this information here. So another point to be made here is that we like to use, although these paper maps are quite useful to look at and present information, we like to use the GIS maps where we use layers of information, and you can turn those layers on and off and sort of tailor the maps for your purposes. So maybe you put the parcel numbers on to get to understand, you know, how the area is divided, but maybe then you turn it off, turn off the parcel mapping information to present information to the public. Okay, another thing to look at here is the actual the red sort of rectangle area. That's what was called the approximate site area. And within there, you'll see other features. And you'll notice, too, that this map does not seem to indicate that the entire site has some concerns in terms of contamination. But you will notice in the middle there is this triangle landfill area. And in that landfill area with the hatch marks, you know, that is definitely one of the areas of concern. And that has like a footprint of what the landfill looks like. So quite specifically, that will be one feature or area that will need ICs. And we will want to not only have this map that shows it, which is either based on either like a survey information or just some kind of maps that exist, but you'll want to actually have something that describes the limits of this area. So you probably, if we are trying to understand the area, we're going to have a survey that's done. We might have drawings from, if this is a capped area, we might have drawings, as-built drawings, which included surveys. And those usually are turned into legal descriptions, and then that could be included in a type of IC. So, again, the map is a very important piece, but it doesn't have all of the information we need, so then we have to sort of supplement that. Another important feature of this map here, just mention it briefly, are the monitoring wells that are noted here. And the monitoring wells here and here, some are abandoned. That one's abandoned. That one's still being used, it's an active groundwater monitoring well, we may want to consider a type of IC to protect that monitoring well from being destroyed or to ensure it's being maintained. So from this map, you can kind of see how you're able to really help tailor the type of ICs that you need for your particular situation. And again, this is just one example of that. So let me go into another type of map that we use oftentimes. And sometimes, as I mentioned, it's good to have them done separately because these maps can get busy. But what we're looking at here is, you know, this little black rectangle here was probably the source area, and the other areas, the groundwater, where the groundwater has come to be, groundwater contamination has come to be located, the plume maps. And this map is very useful to kind of see the areas where you'll need to consider getting restrictions in place. This is more or less a footprint. It doesn't really tell you the depths of the contamination, but you could include that either on this map or separately, which will also help you to get your ICs implemented. Are we talking about, you know, just a certain aquifer? Are we talking about the whole area? Also, that it doesn't really mention the types of contaminants or the levels, but those could be included here. So from this groundwater map, contamination map, then you can go ahead and start to map out the areas for ICs. We have several options of ICs. Obviously, as Steve mentioned, with the four types of ICs, we could use something like a governmental control. If, say, this whole area is in one county, maybe we go to the county government and discuss with them whether a groundwater ordinance for all of this area could be used, whether they're willing to do that, whether they have the resources to do that. Or we could go parcel by parcel and look at covenants on each of those properties. So again, these groundwater maps and these, you know, contamination maps lead to help us get our IC maps tailored and our ICs in place. And you'll see now that there is a poll number 2 that is popped up, and I'm going to turn it over to Jean to describe that.
Thank you. So we do have our second question that's appearing in the lower left half of your screen. In this case, we're asking you to indicate if you have used maps or other visuals to delineate ICs. So if you haven't voted in this poll, please take a moment to scan the question, and you simply need to click the circle to the left of the answer that most closely matches your reply. From the votes that have come in so far, and it looks like we've got about two-thirds of the audience who have voted, and those numbers are creeping up, it looks like almost 90%, so around 86% of the audience have indeed used maps or other visuals already to delineate their ICs. About 7% of the audience have not, and about an equal percentage are planning on doing so in the future.
And I just want to say that's excellent that we see almost 90% usage of maps and other visuals. Very old records of decision, we were lucky to get even a map of what a site looked like, and now we're really starting to understand the importance of mapping and visuals and how to drill down and how this helps us with our job. So it's good to see that it's being of useful out there. So now I'm going to go to another, I'm gonna kind of turn away from the mapping now, and I'm gonna talk about amending documents for ICs. And there are many reasons that we need to amend our decision documents to include ICs, and I'm just gonna go into a few of the circumstances leading to that. I've already mentioned briefly that some of the REDs in the earlier days didn't actually get into specifics. They might have talked about just ICs being required and not much else. So these are some of the circumstances when we're in, you know, down the road trying to make sure we understand whether the ICs have been properly implemented, whether they include the areas that need to be included, whether they have the proper objectives. And sometimes then that leads to us needing to amend our decision document to help understand that for for us and for the public. And as a side note, I'm going to go over the different types of amended documents in the next slide. So I'm just talking now about the circumstances that may be leading to needing an amendment. Another big reason that we see often are the new information comes in, a change of anticipated land use. In the past, we had thought, made decisions based on maybe it was going to be a commercial industrial, and now there's a big push to get residential, and maybe that's going to be a driver for this, and it may mean additional work, remedial work. It may mean additional ICs. Different contamination, newly identified contamination. It could be in an area where we already know we had contamination, but it's migrated or it's found in other areas, maybe a different pathway. For example, I had a lead site I was working on where we had smelter stack emissions, and then down the road we found out we also had battery remains, battery fragments, which contained lead. So there's a whole other type of contamination. It was in a different area. And so not only would that lead to a new decision document in terms of whether maybe we need to update our remedy, but also maybe ICs and pathways. Maybe a new pathway comes into, we find out about a new pathway. It could be something like vapor intrusion, as we're going through. And so not only do we look at whether that's going to affect the active remedy, but also whether we need additional ICs. A lot of times these come up through the five-year reviews. The five-year review is the mechanism that we use it, where we do a review, snapshot in time, basically, at least every 5 years to determine if our remedy is protective in the short term and the long term. We look at, when we're doing the five-year review, we look at what the decision document called for, and does that still make sense, what it called for in terms of what we know today? What is the current condition? Have we found new contamination? Have some of the standards changed? So we're looking at current conditions, we're looking at what the remedy called for, and we're seeing if that still is adequate. If not, that may lead to amending a decision document. Or are the ICs that were called for, which we think are adequate, have they been put in place? And if not, what's holding that up? Is it something that the ICs weren't clarified enough and we need to do some sort of legwork to figure that out? Or is it something where, say, we selected restrictions on properties and the landowners do not feel like they want to cooperate for whatever reason, and therefore we're having to go back and change that? So, the five-year review often is something that brings up brings up the amendments to documents. Construction completion, sometimes that will happen where we are going down the pathway of trying to get these, getting our remedy built, the remedial design, remedial action, and also looking to get those ICs in place. As Steve said, the best practice would be to have been working on these ICs along with the active remedy, but sometimes that doesn't happen, it's done later. But in those cases, the construction completion of the remedy may lead to another understanding. Maybe we have a larger area that we need to have more ICs in place, or maybe we found something we didn't anticipate. Anyways, that could lead to a reconsideration of the decision document. Deletion. Deletions where all response actions should be complete, and we're sort of describing that and deleting the site. But sometimes a roadblock is found with the deletions, because even though the ICs may be in place, maybe the decision document didn't really call for it or it wasn't clear. So in those cases, we may be amending our decision documents to clarify that the ICs indeed were required for the protectiveness, and then we can go ahead and move forward with the deletion. Okay, some of the other considerations. the significance of ICs in the overall remedial strategy. Okay, so IC only remedies. Well, we had heard from Steve, I think it was, that mentioned the NCP discourages ICs being used as the only type of remedy, that it should be used in conjunction with active remedial remedies. But there are some times where IC only remedies, you know, are appropriate. Maybe there was a lot of work done before we had gotten the site into the remedial program, and then the only thing needed, maybe there's a removal action, the only thing needed would be ICs. There are other circumstances. So even though it's discouraged in the NCP, it may be appropriate, and we do have some examples of IC only remedies. And so just wanted to point that out. A consideration also is the short and long-term needs of the ICs. So in many cases, we're going to have long-term needs for these ICs. We'll have waste left in place, we'll have a landfill or containment area, and the ICs just need to be in place into perpetuity, just like the maintenance of the landfill. But there are other times when it only needs to be in place for short term, and we have the ability to sort of call that out in our decision document to determine, you know, what our needs are. An example of a short-term IC need might be where we have a groundwater plume, that we have natural attenuation occurring, and we have some estimates that it might take 10 years, you know, to remediate, to get to the standards. So maybe an IC in the interim would be an appropriate way to go to make sure that our remedy is protective. So this should be considered and discussed in the decision document. And the next point leads to actually what type of remedy, what type of amendment to the remedy is needed. So what we need to look at is what is the overall waste management approach that was discussed in the original decision document, and think about whether the public had noticed whether that there could be some waste left in place. How was the public affected by that? And so that sort of leads to the next discussion of, if we decide we do need to amend a document to add ICs, maybe it'll include other components, what type of document should we use? Now, one type that's not mentioned here, the ESC or RAD amendments mentioned here, one type is just would be the memo to the file. These are very small changes in our approach, just something we want to make clarification. That might be something, just a clarification to the file. But then the two other types, the ESD or RAD amendment. So the ESD is used to document significant changes, and I'm sure the audience understands this, so I'm not going to belabor it. And the RAD amendment is for fundamental changes. But the idea here is, if you have a remedy that you need to document some changes, then did the public understand that we were going to leave waste in place, essentially? What was the original waste management approach? So if the original approach was we were going to treat contaminated area and it would lead to UUUE, there was no need for ICs, that's one thing. But if through a change, whatever it was, TI or just, you know, something happening to the approach, now we're going to leave some kind of waste there, we're going to have some kind of containment, we're going to need ICs, that is a fundamental change. So that would lead to a RAD amendment, and therefore, you know, the ICs would be discussed in terms of that. Public participation is an aspect that we need to consider. The public should have meaningful involvement, as Melanie said. So one of the considerations is when you're determining what is the appropriate document is, did the public have enough notice to know that how they may be affected, or that how the area might be affected? So essentially, the ESD is one of those things that doesn't normally include public participation in the sense of going out for full public comment, but sometimes based on the community or the change that's happened, we might think that the ESD is the appropriate mechanism, that a RAD amendment is not necessary, but that the public should be involved. And there's nothing that prevents us from doing that. And so site-specific determination, whether you do an ESD or RAD amendment, and whether you do an ESD with public comment. And some regions term that as the ESD plus. Next slide here. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail about planning for ICs because that could be a whole separate seminar, really. But sort of in review here, the planning for ICs should start early during the RAFS and continue through implementation. It should be as if any, it should be considered as any other remedy component. And a lot of considerations need to be brought into the mix that should be hopefully sort of sorted out by the time the decision document is signed, but not always. But the things are like, what are the objectives of the ICs? What do we need it for? What media? What are we trying to prevent? Are we trying to ask that certain things be maintained? What are the duration, remember, short-term versus long-term? Number of parcels requiring restriction, because that may affect what type of IC document or instrument we use. Support of ICs by affected landowners. Maybe our landowner didn't know that they would be affected, even though they had noticed that ICs would be used. So that's something that if we can try to figure that out by the time we have a decision document, that's something that should be considered. If not, it'll, I hate to say this, but rear its ugly head later, and we may be fighting a battle down the road if we haven't thought about that by the time we selected that. Important aspect are, say, state and local government cooperation. Many times we are using our local and state government counterparts to help get these ICs in place. We may not have the authority to put an ordinance in place. We're looking to our counterparts there, and we need to understand if they have the authority to do that, if they are willing to do that, if they have the enforcement ability, and whether they actually have the power, the manpower to do it. And if not, you know, we need to talk through all of that and see if that can go. Tribal considerations, many tribes have, even though they have all of the authorities for all of these ICs, and we have, as Steve mentioned, a guidance on that, sometimes some of the tribes don't understand what we're trying to do, so we need to work with them early. We need to get them on board, the understanding, and we need to understand their issues. Sometimes they just really, through some of their past practices, they just don't believe in restrictions on properties or restrictions on, say, fish usage. So that may become a problem then if we select that on the tribal site and then it becomes a problem later. So many more. There's, like I said, this could be a whole seminar, but getting ICs in place from planning to implementation, there are a lot of considerations. Speaking about planning, I'm just say a little bit more on the planning documents. And we have been using, like I said, from day one when we were looking for ICs, getting ICs in place, you know, we were going about that process, but now we've sort of put that in a little bit more formal process through these IC plans, which now we're calling ICAPs through the guidance to explain this. But what the ICAPs are, a very flexible way for us to plan and to include all of the aspects of IC implementation, IC work. So it's used to help us implement. It's used to help us discuss the maintenance, who's going to enforce it, talk about that, the termination. Sometimes these ICs are short-term. How is that going to work? This could be discussed in the IC, the ICAP, long-term stewardship. So this is our way of taking what's in the decision document and making it work, putting it into reality. Just a few side notes here. Do not substitute or replace for decision document. Again, it's there to get something implemented, but the decision document is the decision document in terms of what was selected. Best practice would be to develop it during the RD phase because we should do this early. Some of it, many times, it hasn't been done by the time of construction completion, but there's nothing that really stops us from getting those ICs in place, just like the other active remedies. So that should be done as part of that. And the ICAP can be revised as site conditions warrant. So just because we have some questions open during RD doesn't mean we shouldn't start that planning process. And the IC IAP can be amended as needed. So again, it's meant to be a very flexible document. It should discuss the roles and responsibilities of the individuals for the life cycles, the stakeholders, who's going to implement it, or what team, or, you know, who needs to do what, who's going to maintain it, who's going to enforce it. You know, all of that should be discussed in the IC plan. And, again, I'm talking about the EPA guidance. We have recommended template for this type of plan. So I think I'm going to turn this to Jean for the next poll.
Yes, we do have a third poll that's now appearing in the lower left half of your screen. This time we're asking about your success in actually implementing an institutional control. So if you look at the lower left half of your screen, you should see three options, and you can simply click on the circle to the left of the answer that best matches your reply. Again, if there are multiple people sharing the line, you'll have to fight amongst yourselves to pick out one group answer. It does look like from the votes that have come in so far, although those numbers continue to creep up, we're looking at least 3/4 of the audience have been successful in implementing institutional controls. About 1/4 of them, surprisingly, have not tried, and it looks like only a handful of participants indicated that they've not been successful in implementing an IC.
And I would say that is very good news to see this level of success. What we didn't ask in this poll that might have been an important follow-up question would be how long it took.
We can ask them if you want. Feel free to type that into the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen if you have a quick answer and can indicate how many months, years, or how long it took you to become successful in implementing that IC. Feel free to type up that number in the Q&A window, which appears in the lower right corner of your screen. We'll see if we can get any replies.
Okay, thanks, Jean.
No problem.
With that, I think I'm going to turn it back to you to facilitate question and answer.
Oh, just along that, we did have one participant who commented that from draft to final, it took over 1 year to get that IC in place. For an FDEP, 8 months to reject an IC. Another participant mentioned 4 to 5 years for groundwater use, and our next participant took a couple of years to post rod on the site, where their ICs are now very successful, and it does seem to indicate a couple more people are mentioning it's a couple of years to get it, but it was difficult, but once they were in place, they were successful.
Great. Again, the level of success is very impressive.
All right, excellent. Okay, so I think at this point we're going to go ahead and switch gears over to our question and answer portion of the webinar. We've got about 17 minutes or so left in the time remaining. If you have not yet submitted an electronic question using the Q&A window, you can continue to type them up in that window in the lower right corner, but we're going to start with the questions that have already been submitted. And this very first question goes all the way back to the ICTS, and I believe we're going to push this one over to Steve. One of our participants wants to know if the ICTS is publicly available.
Yeah, great question. Thanks very much for all the questions, actually. I look forward to this. ICTS is actually for sites that are where all the ICs are fully implemented. They are available publicly. The link that we provided in the webinar to the IC webpage, EPA's IC webpage, If you go to that link, there's actually a link that appears on the page called Site Reports. And this will bring you to those ICTS sites where ICs have been totally implemented. So you could see specific sites there.
Okay. All right, excellent. I think we're going to bump to another question here where we are, looking at a question about numbers. And Melanie, I believe this question is going to be directed to you. And in this particular case, this question is getting into how you would technically explain a risk number. And one of our participants wants to know if we would basically explain risk as 3 out of 1,000, or would you use the mathematical 3 times 10 e to the negative 3?
Okay, thanks, Jean, and thanks for the question. You know, that nomenclature is pretty standard among decision documents, and I believe the really great decision documents have a large section that describes how the risk analysis is done and how the risk numbers will be presented in the document. And they do discuss in that summary before the actual site numbers are presented, you know, that, you know, 3 times 10 to the minus 3 is the same as 3 in 1,000. So like I said, the good decision documents kind of key up how that nomenclature will be used in the document before it's presented. So I think as long as you, again, keeping in mind that these documents are not only formal for legal purposes, but also for the public, especially the proposed plans, as long as you identify what you mean by 3 times 10 to the minus 3, then that's usually sufficient. And then that can be used throughout the rest of the document.
Okay. Our next one is more of a comment, and this is going to be pushed over to Steve to address. This participant mentions that not all localities recognize covenants corresponding to land use. For example, covenants recorded over the history of land use include no black, Jews, or people with income less than 20,000 are typical examples of local covenants that were recorded in land records. Local county or city attorneys do not recognize covenants in the subdivision of land, rezoning, or other deed restrictions that are relevant to current land use. So perhaps, Steve, you might be able to provide a comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to any specific case, but what I would say, and hopefully it captured the sentiment of the original person who submitted the question, but I think really this kind of reinforces that thought that, you know, up front, I mean, especially when we're in remedy selection, we really need to, you know, think about what types of ICs are feasible at the site. You know, I talked about 4 four different types, and within those categories, there are multiple ICs that you can use. It's important that having those considerations in mind, you know, these localities, specific maybe circumstances, it's really important to have that in mind when you're determining what type of IC you want. So I can't, you know, kind of speak to the specifics there, but I would say that it reinforces that we need to have really early coordination to kind of ferret out these issues in advance so that when we're really getting to the point of selecting a remedy, we kind of know the state of play and we kind of know these considerations and we can make our best kind of judgment on an IC type based on those circumstances.
Okay. We have 2 comments or questions that I think are related, so I'm going to bring them both in together. And I am going to point these first to you, Steve, but Sherry, you might be able to help with these questions. So the first question is relating to slides 24 and 25. The participant asks how and who would enforce the prohibitions and requirements. And then related to that, we have another question from another participant who asked what types of certifications are required, for example, your site inspections, et cetera, for ICs that are used to prevent exposure to contaminated soil.
Sure. Be happy to take a kind of a first stab. The specific example that Melanie covered, example 2 on the slides, I think was an example of a proprietary control covenant or an easement. In general, kind of the enforcement would depend on what type of IC you're talking about. So since example 2 covered proprietary control, I'd say in general, whoever is a grantee, on that proprietary control would be able to kind of seek the legal action against the property owner. If they were doing something that's kind of against what the objectives of the IC are. But for other types of IC categories, that can be different who has kind of the enforcement hand in it. So for governmental controls, it would be the local government jurisdiction or a state agency. So it can definitely vary. For informational devices, it may not be enforceable at all. And so, that's a consideration as well. For the second question, Gene, about certifications, in our guidance, we actually recommend, in the absence of a more defined period, annual certification that ICs are in place and they're effective. It does, again, depend, as anything we're saying here, this all depends on site-specific circumstances. So you can imagine, not all sites that we have in the Superfund program are created equal. They don't have the, sort of similar conditions that we can, we have to generalize across. But for sites that you anticipate, greater changes in land use that need to be monitored more frequently, you would probably want to have a period, maybe once a year, to certify that ICs are effective. But we also have a number of industrial sites. They're fenced off. They're owned by a potentially responsible party. Cleanup is underway. We know that there's not a lot of intervention on the site, especially by people that aren't authorized to be on site. So those kinds of sites don't require the same, maybe a year certification on the ICs is not as necessary. I can tell you that Superfund has, a backstop, and I talked about this in my part of the slides. We have a five-year view process. So at least every 5 years, the agency can go back and say, as part of the five-year view, if ICs were part of the remedy, we're going to evaluate that component of the remedy. So we know at least at that point that we're doing a site inspection. We may be doing title searches, depends again on the nature of the IC, but we should have certification at least every 5 years, hopefully every year, but depending on the circumstances of the site, maybe a little bit longer time frame. And Sherry, I don't know if you have something to add.
Let's see. I would add the following. In terms of the enforcement of the ICs, as Steve mentioned, depends on the type of IC. For proprietary controls, the ones that attach to the land, usually there are provisions in those the deed documents that say who can enforce it. And this is something the agency's been working on a lot to understand the state law in each state that applies and to see what type of language needs to be included to make sure that the proper parties can enforce it. So not only would you want, say, the previous property owner or the grantee, the grantor, but you might want the agency to have that authority. So we've been listed in many of these documents as third-party beneficiaries who have enforcement rights. In terms of the local government documents, say the ordinances, it depends how the ordinance is drafted and enacted. This is something that the agency will look at when we're evaluating whether the ordinance is effective. Does it have a provision for enforcement? Who has the authority to do that? Oftentimes it would be the local government. Sometimes these ordinances have no provision for enforcement. It's just something that it's on the books, but there's no authority. And then another thing we look at is even though there may be enforcement authority, does the local government do that work? Do they enforce it? Do they have the resources to do it? Sometimes we found out that it is a resource issue, and we're able to figure out how to get them more resources. And then the last thing I wanted to say is another way to get enforcement authority is through some of our enforcement documents, the consent decree, the UAO, the CDs that we have, or the AOCs that we have, could have specific provisions for enforcement, and that's how we can get our authority to enforce some of these ICs.
Okay. We're going to move on to another question. This one will be directed towards Melanie. And this participant is asking, in this example involving the VOC plume, would treatment or other remedial action also be employed? If not, what's the virtue of an IC if the plume spreads and contaminate other groundwater resources?
Okay. I think the slide in question was the one related to the common elements of the alternatives. I hope so. So if that's the case, then again, I'm just reminding you, this is the common elements section of the ROD. And so I'm going to presume, again, because we generally don't do IC-only remedies, that the common elements is highlighting ICs as part of all of the remedial alternatives, but that the specific remedial alternatives themselves will identify the active remedial measures that are going to be components of each of those alternatives. So I would say that the ICs, again, are acting in supplement to the active remedial alternatives rather than in lieu of. Hope that answers the question.
I think it does. We have another question on another example that you provided, and this one is referring to the remedy description. I think it was labeled example 2. If the tool, whether it's an EC ordinance, is not specific, how does EPA and state know what is feasible, for example, without coordinating with landowners or the local government?
Okay. Well, again, you know, we always walk this really, like, tight line with regard to ICs and the level of documentation in our decision documents, because at the time of remedy selection, the specific mechanism may not be known or may not be available. And sometimes we don't really want to wait to select a remedy until we're able to more clearly define the mechanism for the IC. In some cases, like the second example, or example 3, I was numbered, we did know the mechanisms that were available to us and we selected them. But in the first example, or example 2, it was not known at that time what the mechanism was. So, again, going back to our substantive documentation for ICs, which is, it has to be clear the scope and intent of the restrictions. And while the mechanism may not be known, what is known in both of these examples and then elaborated on in the second one is what needs to be restricted, who needs to be prevented from the use, and how they're going to, and how long that's going to last. So, I mean, that's all we can really say about the level of detail for ICs. And, you know, I will say that this is sufficient for our purposes at this time. As you will recall, and some other people have indicated that, you know, they're looking at rods from the 90s. I haven't seen a rod from the 80s that discusses ICs, but from the 90s, you know, it says ICs are needed. And how do we, you know, move forward with that? So that's really difficult. So if you get something like this that says clearly that residents should not be drinking the groundwater, that's a huge step in the right direction. And that indicates to residences when they're reading the proposed plan, when they're reading the ROD, that they know that they can't drink the groundwater at the site. And that's the fundamental purpose of institutional controls, is to restrict the uses and so that the parties who need to be restricted are aware of it.
Okay. We have another question that's, we're going to push over to Steve, and this one is about the LUCs and ICs. So they state that LUCs and ICs are terms used synonymously sometimes, but they are not the same in the sense that one is a subset of the other. Can you explain the difference between each of these terms?
Yeah, I covered a little bit on my slide, just to expand a little bit then. That's correct. And that's something we've had to, you know, kind of explain in our guidance, because I think, you know, depending on what authority you may be working under and what kind of site you're dealing with, you may kind of see these terms used interchangeably. But ICs are a subset of LUCs. So LUCs are a little bit more expansive. They include, you know, how we defined ICs here in this presentation, but they can also include what we've defined more closer to engineering controls. So things like fencing and security guards are the two examples I provided. It's kind of the example we provide in guidance as well. as something, well, that is physical. Those two things are physical controls. We define ICs as administrative and legal tools, so we don't consider fencing to be ICs. But if you see documents with the term Lux, it may be. So my slide was a little bit of a caution to kind of keep track of the lingo there. The same thing with the term that I put in the slide as well with the post-removal site controls. It's the same thing. ICs are a subset, but it can be much more expansive than that. It could even include engineered caps. So it's important to have those terms, memorized in your head of kind of what you're dealing with there. And ICs are a subset of both those terms.
Okay. I think I'm going to take one more question here. And whatever we didn't get through in the time that we had allotted, again, we did provide contact information for all of our presenters. So if your question wasn't asked out loud or addressed today, you can certainly reach out to our instructors to follow on with additional questions or comments. Let me just get through this one last question, and this one I think, Steve, is also going to be directed to you. One of these participants wants to know if you have recommendations on how to solicit input on ICs from the impacted community. The FS and proposed plan, even the ROD, is sometimes light on IC details. Is it typical to accept public comments on your IC IPA?
We've heard instances where the IC plan, the ICAP, we have gone out for public comment, and that's, if that's the right step at the site. We've had, it's kind of like I said in my response to another question. Again, this is all very site-specific and kind of the level of involvement of the community. Sometimes we have ICs at sites where the community is relatively disengaged, and so we wouldn't be prescriptive about ICAP should always go out for public comment. I think they can at the appropriate types of sites, the ones where we have a little bit more engagement. ICs may be a more primary component of the remedy, maybe a main component. We don't see a lot of IC-only remedies, at least on the private side of the Superfund universe of sites. What I mean by that is the non-federal facility sites. But in cases like that, there could be considerations where you would want to go out and for an IC plan with public comment or have public meetings related to it, posters, things like that to kind of get the information out. We wanted to acknowledge, too, with the IC plans, part of why we think an IC plan is a really powerful tool is it's the one-stop source for IC information that you can't possibly have in the ROD. A lot of what we recommend in our ICAP guidance, which has a kind of a template form for people to use, is that a lot of this is done during the remedial design phase of Superfund. So you're talking about after remedy selection at that point. So you're talking about writing a ROD, signing a ROD, and then during the design of the remedy, the physical remedy, you're also working on kind of some of these IC details. And that's where you're going into the long-term stewardship procedures and things like that. So you get a little bit more detail there. We wouldn't want a ROD to, be some insane level of detail, something that we are traditionally used to seeing on the IC front, at least from those long-term stewardship perspectives, because we're trying to put everything in the kitchen sink in the ROD.
Okay, great. I think we have gotten right up to that scheduled end time for today's webinar. So before we start our closeout procedures, where I'll remind everyone how you can access the slides as well as provide feedback for today's live broadcast, I just wanted to present each of our three instructors today with a final opportunity for any final closing reminders or items you might want to leave the audience with. Sherry, anything from Region 5? Okay, I'll take silence as a no. How about Melanie and Steve here in headquarters? Anything you want to leave the audience with?
Yeah, Gene, I realize, unfortunately, we ran out of time, and we see that there's a lot of questions in the queue. So, in the spirit of, hopefully being able to answer your question, and we want to answer your questions, you see on the slides, actually the slide that's up right now, there's contact information for all three of us. Please feel free to get in touch. We'd be happy to answer your questions.
Okay, excellent. Well, with that, let me walk everybody through our final reminders before we close things out today. First, I'd like to provide a great big thank you to those instructors who were able to join us from both EPA headquarters as well as out in Region 5. I also want to thank the nearly 230 individuals who were able to join us from across the country for today's live broadcast. Just a few final reminders before we let everyone go today. A number of participants have asked about training records or how to keep a list of the webinars that they participate in. We do have a website you can visit on CLUIN where if you enter your email address and click the Submit Request button, it will send an automated email to that email listing every internet seminar that used that email address when registering if you checked in for the live events. So we can at least give you an automated list of everything you've participated based off of your email address. If that's not enough or you find that that list is somehow incorrect or incomplete, feel free to email me directly at ballant.gene@epa.gov and I'll be happy to work with you to update the list. We do have copies of the presentation materials available to download. They are listed in a PDF format. You can certainly access those either from the seminar homepage or from the resources or links page. On that page, you'll also find a link to the Superfund IC's homepage where you'll find a variety of the resources that were discussed today. I will also ask if you could take just a short moment and fill out our online feedback form. I do read each and every one of those feedback form submissions to help us to ensure we can improve future deliveries and continue to offer free internet seminars through CLUIN. For those of you who are looking to document your participation in today's seminar for CEUs or PDHs, we don't necessarily offer those particular credit hours. However, many people are still able to earn credit for attending our seminars. If you keep a copy of your registration or confirmation email, also sometimes keeping a copy of the seminar homepage or the seminar training slides is helpful. But if you fill out that online feedback form, there is a box which is circled in red on this slide. As long as your email address is entered correctly and you check that box, you will receive an automated confirmation email after you submit feedback, verifying you provided your feedback for the webinar after the live event. So usually people are able to get full credit for participating by showing that they registered, by having some piece of information from the training, and then having a copy of that confirmation email. This will still work for those of you replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, so you can still watch the entire webinar online. You can submit your own feedback form as well as download copies of the presentation materials and get one of these confirmation emails if you need it. Again, I want to thank the nearly 230 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast. We did record today's session, and each of you will receive an automated email with a link to replay the recorded version as soon as we have our archive available. So thank you again all very much for joining us for today's live broadcast, and I hope that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN webinar. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live Internet seminar.